it's real important for someone who turns himself inside out, as a writer does, and I suppose really as anyone who talks does, to take the chance of telling on yourself a little bit. And I think this is the only way that I can begin, is to say a little bit about who I am, so that we get over that hump. The fact that my name is Herb Brokering and that you spell it K-E-R-I-N-G, you know, becomes terribly important to people when you are traveling and they ask you over and over about yourself, how do you spell that name again? It seems to, you know, be a very important question. And you did get a little tired of being asked only, how do you spell your last name? So when you think and when you write and when you are creative, you become quite personal and quite interpersonal. I guess the two go together. And you take the chance also of saying things that you wish later you hadn't said, and maybe that others wish you they hadn't heard or didn't have to hear. I'm going to do a little show and tell, and I hope that if some of us have a chance to be together often, that some of you will do a lot of showing and telling, of reading what you like to read, reading what you have written, reading what you will write, maybe reading what you heard someone else say. It has never been in writing, but it should be. The person didn't know what a great sentence she said. I think a writer borrows from the people whom he reads and from the people with whom he eats and drinks. Waitresses are a great source of inspiration. They, in all of their hurried life and in all of their reality, they say a sentence which is so great you mustn't miss it. You must write it down. I do write it down. I always have paper with me and write down, not long speeches, but I write down single sentences and thoughts about which I want to do some thinking, things that I don't want to get away. This morning was my first time here to see this altar, and I pondered that altar considerably. I wondered, I did not really wonder how much the altar weighed, but I wondered if it looked as though it was heavy because the lines moved down. How would an altar look if it was pitched so that the lines came up? It might look lighter. It looks like a very heavy altar because the weight seems to be directed toward the ground. And I thought, well, an altar really is not a symbol to take us into orbit, but an altar really is a symbol for a meeting place on the earth. So I said, I'm glad whoever cut those ends, cut them in that way. I had quite a conversation with the altar. I asked it questions. I asked the people who made it all kinds of questions. I haven't the slightest idea, in a sense I don't really care who made it, how much it weighs, what kind of wood it is. Because that altar, to me, has meaning, of course, that meaning, and that was meaningful to the men and the women who made it. But that is not the meaning that I'm trying to restore. I'm trying to discover another meaning, and then to share it, and give it to you partially with an et cetera at the end, or with three dots at the end in a row, and say to you, you go from there. And take it just any way you want it. If you want to write an altar anthem, fine. It would be all right. I probably won't write an altar anthem because I just said it. I don't usually write what I said. I usually say what I wrote. I do it the other, that's the way I do it. If I talk too much about a thing, I don't want to write it anymore. I don't usually need to write it. Maybe that's it, because I've already said it. I began most of my creative writing after 10 years in the parish ministry, I suppose because coming to the main office, headquarters, whatever we call it, of the American Lutheran Church, and not having a regular Sunday pulpit, not having 80 funerals a year, not having a lot of opportunity to teach and to preach and to talk and to counsel, I sat early into early morning hours to write to all the people with whom I was now not meeting. Now, this altar, if I may just spend a little more time with it, part of my work is to write and design primarily curriculum materials for the confirmation classes of the American Lutheran Church. And our very last unit to come out is called My Worship Life. I consider it a rather creative unit. I consider most of the units not creative. That is, if paper can be creative, people can, paper can't. But paper can nudge people in a certain direction. Here is one on worship life, and here, for instance, in each of these 10 lessons, we touch on some aspect of seeing worship in a new way. Here, for instance, we are designing a pew. I guess I could say the same about an altar. But what is a pew? Well, a pew is something you could order from a company in Hickory, North Carolina. I guess that's where a lot of them come from. And they cost about $125 a piece. And if you can get someone to donate one, then you don't have to have a special drive. A pew is a place to sit. But I thought about that more and thought that really a pew is a place where people meet. I think that pews can be very, very discouraging as a meeting place. We don't usually meet linearly, but we are now. And we took ourselves away from the circle. I made this decision, and I don't know why now. We took ourselves away from a circle and put ourselves into lines. The pew is a place where people meet, and I would say if the pew in being straight can't be a meeting place, then bend it. Well, you'd say you can't bend a pew. It's ridiculous. Well, a lot of poetry is ridiculous, I suppose, and a lot of the thinking that goes on is right, but it's ridiculous. It's very expensive thinking. I think that creative thinking is mostly something you can never afford to buy. A congregation can never own. You can only have it in the imagination of your mind. So you can still sit in a straight line and think curved. I'd say it would help if the congregation rose one Sunday and those on this half got a hold of this end of the pew and they went like this and those on the other end and they imagined that the pew would be bowed, and that all of the ends and the pastor would say from the lectern so that everybody would hear it, do it a little harder so everybody could see each other. You wouldn't really have to break the pew to do that. You wouldn't have to unscrew anything. You wouldn't probably ever have to say it again. You wouldn't have to say it in your bulletin week after week. We're a friendly congregation. I'd put them through some kind of a friendly action, something that violates something perhaps in them, makes some of them quit the church maybe. They may quit you for a while. That wouldn't hurt. I think we all have to quit each other and rediscover each other, and we quit ourselves and we discover ourselves too. That's what I feel. So I thought of how could you design a pew that could be a meeting place. You take that idea, well, I won't tell you. We'll just take that idea now and ask you, how could a pew be a meeting place? I've already said if we could bend them, how else could a pew be a meeting place? If a pew was swivel chairs, it could be a meeting place. Now, that's what young people said. We're a little older than these young people who said it. After five, we're all in half cement at least. I don't know whether we're in cement from the top down or from the bottom up. By the time we're five, we're well in cement. It took quite a few hours for young people to say to me one day, then the pews would have to swivel. That's great. And they don't have to, yes.
Well, they could be shorter.
Mm. Like if you had three and 10 foot island application,
so that they
bend around
the edge.
Okay, so if you had a section and section and section and you had it that way, suction cups on the, so you wouldn't always have to screw and unscrew it. It just must be another way to hold a pew to the floor. A lot of screws don't work either, so there must be other ways. How else? Yes. Yes, sir. Yes.
Oh, they could have backs that would move. They could move it to back and couldn't face each other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. You thought of that?
Just if this part could come down and be the seat, that would be the back. Mm-hmm. We'd be facing each other.
Pardon?
Like the old railroad cars.
Yeah, like the cars on a railroad.
Yes, the old railroad cars. You can make it go either way. The pull, yes.
Yeah, it's still on the floor.
Okay, that means we'll have to do something with the floor now and with the chancel. So actually, by the time we reconstruct these buildings, most of our churches become obsolete. And if we had sessions like this to rethink this, just as we rethink the budget of our church, if we rethought this every month, we'd have to have plastic churches. So very pliable. Yes.
We could meet in homes and use our own music floor.
All right. Then you say that the pew now is already in, it's in the house, and it's the sofa, it's the rocking chair. Yes, sir.
With the pre-thin art, there's more of a tendency now to, I mean, they could be straight, but they're shorter, just like here. I mean, there's a tendency to make a semicircle in here.
There is already, yes.
And if they're shorter, like maybe this bench right here, maybe between a 3 or 4, to form a semicircle.
Or like just cut them into 18-inch sections.
You mean take the ones we've got?
Yeah.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
One kid said, let's have all the pews be one and make it a spiral. And then you'll all be in the same pew. You wouldn't have any problem about who the usher's ushering one row and the second row, you know, it just, you wouldn't have any trouble about anybody not sitting in the front row, because where would the front row be now? In the center. That's a tremendous thought, to think that the front row is the center. I just think on that one a while. If I had paper and pencil time, I'd write that one down. I'd want to think about that a great deal, to think that the front row was at the center. You like that? I do too. Because something about the front row now that doesn't feel central. All right, and now, that's really what a writer does, I guess. I'm just going to show several things, and we're going to go to some of these things from day to day. That's just a piece of curriculum which has many, many descriptions, such as a new look at a pew, a new look at a font, a new look at church art as decoration and not just as stained glass window, but decoration. If you could decorate a church, you ask the decorative-minded person how to decorate a church, and there is not much of an opportunity to decorate a church. How would you decorate a church? Streamers, but if you, as the kid said, if you didn't have any windows, so that the walls could essentially be for decorating, you could decorate for the sun, you could decorate for the season. If the church, the interior of the church said, decorate me because I'm not in the right decor, you know, you'd feel like it. In fact, you'd do it without even organizing a committee to do it. You'd just say the church is for people who believe in decorating. You could decorate then for the Sunday, and everybody would walk in, and you could get the feeling of the color and the mood and the kind of information that is in the epistle or the gospel lesson in terms of then and also in terms of our world now. That's one. Another kind of writing which I did originally is I wrote originally for a book called I Think of Jesus, which the publishing house didn't want to publish. So I thought, what do you do with an insult? That's what a creative writer always has to do. He has to go with the blow. You have to say to somebody, you have to say when somebody else has said something about your writing that isn't quite what you want, then you have to say to yourself, who else will, or what now? So I showed this writing to someone who reads, and he said, but this was never meant to be a book, this was meant to be a record. So that I Think of Jesus actually was play over 1,200 stations 4 years in a row during the Lenten season. And then when it was popular to the ear, then the people who published turned around and said, why shouldn't we print that? But it was another publishing house. And so it waited a while. Creativity waits. It conceives, and sometimes it doesn't. It's barren. But even to be, you know, barren is waiting. We know that Scripture speaks of Advent. I suppose if I were to choose an Advent character, the barren one waiting, I would choose Sarah as one example of Advent. I don't know, I've never thought of Sarah as connected with Advent before this moment. It's almost a great moment. It's 21 minutes after 11. And sometimes a creative person does clock what he says. I do. I write down sometimes the time and the place when, because these are times that I don't want to forget, at least for a while. Then there becomes so many, it becomes like a diary that you no longer keep track. Once in a while you do. And Sarah to me is an Advent character, waiting. Well, there are the barren times, and then I Think of Jesus eventually became a book. Some of my writing, and I have it here in three different forms, has become cantatas, five of them. Well, they were written to be cantatas, but I really didn't know what a cantata was. I just knew that I wanted to write in four or five columns. And so by writing in four or five or three columns, I was actually writing four voices, because if you take these columns like this and you turn them like this, and you give the soprano the one and the alto another. And so I began to write in columns. And this I did with for a man named Dan Moe. I did this for a man named Lee Satter. I did this for a man named Paul Fetter. I like to do this for people I know. I do not like to do this for strangers. Although I think about it, and my wife is here. I believe in monogamy, and I believe in knowing the person and to whom I give myself. I believe in I believe that I must know the artist quickly, if I did not know him before, who wants to do something with what I wrote. And I have a lot of requests. I only once gave it out promiscuously, and I felt prostituted by it, still do. I don't like the whole situation at all. I wrote it for these people, and so actually, in the whole field of writing for others, I guess that's the only reason I write anyway. I don't write for myself. I want someone else to read it and then dance it. Some have danced. Some have danced before I even thought of it. I think of the pastor's wife who came in one day to the office and shut the door. Silently, so that no one might hear, told me that she had done choreography when she was a bit younger, and she, in her parsonage now in the Midwest, had pulled the curtains and locked the door and taped this, and was now dancing the book called In the Rustling Grass. Well, it has a longer story to it than that. I was glad when she could dance it. And I'm glad when someone can take it and say it should be read, and he's a man who reads. I'm glad when someone says, I can write notes to it. And I can have choirs sing it. I have no control over them. And I don't want to have any control over them. I don't want you to have any control over my writing. I never have someone preview my writing. I never have anybody do a critique on my writing. Maybe I'm a coward. Maybe that's part of what a creative person is too. I don't know. I don't do that. I will read to you from some pieces that I know will go to print. Maybe no publisher knows it yet, but I know it because that's another feeling that a creative person has. A mother knows when she's pregnant, even when all the people on the street doesn't know, she knows. And I know when I have conceived a good thing. When someone says to me, as a publishing house did several years ago, by the way, it's also a brazen, very brave and gutty guy, I guess, once in a while, who flings his stuff to publishing houses with covering letters saying, what I send you is great. I mean, nobody says this for you unless you have an agent. And then, you know, then I begin to suspect, why does the agent say it's great? So I don't want this agent. Maybe I'll find an agent whom I want, but I don't have an agent. So it keeps one very busy. Publishing house asked me to write a story for children, an Easter story. I wrote it. It was in rhythm. It was in rhyme. I liked it. I thought this would be a good one for them. And they sent it back and said they had wanted one for children to which an artist could draw and paint. And this was so visual already in the words that they couldn't do it, couldn't use it, see. I'd gone too far. So, and then a little P.S. saying, it's rather like a ballad. And I was glad for the clue. So then someone sang it. And I liked it better anyway. It didn't need the artist. Not that artist. It needed a singer. And it hasn't been printed. I think someday it will be. It'll be an Easter ballad. I had never written a ballad. I didn't know what a ballad was. I was trained for parish ministry, majored in Greek. No, I really didn't know that that was a ballad until someone said it's a ballad. Thanked them for that and got their rejection slip. I like to write to something visual. Some of you know of Sister Noemi, who is a photographer in the St. Scholastica Priory in Duluth. And several years ago, a Baptist freelance artist. I like freelance artists partly because they're hungry. They're hungrier than I, which is like having a $25,000 house and a $15,000 session from our previous lecture. But they're hungrier than I am because I also have the security of a job. And I'm not only freelancing, because freelancing that I do is called moonlighting. It's more promiscuous, I think. Freelancing, you're expected to do some things. But moonlighting is a little wicked. So Sister Noemi and I met through this Baptist artist. So here are three faiths already meeting, and we were to do a bulletin for the Evangelical Free Press, which is the fourth, and it was rejected. So Sister Noemi and her mother superior saw the bulletins that were rejected and said, let's meet somehow. Well, we'll meet on Reformation Sunday or day, Reformation Day. This Baptist artist and I headed for Duluth, so we got there and we're very glad and sat at the table and said, well, this is quite a day. They said, yes, it is quite a day. It was Christ the King Day in their convent. So we heard all about Christ the King Day, and they heard all about the Reformation, and we continued to meet, and I have since seen thousands and thousands of her photographs. This photograph, for instance, looking at it, looks as though it's dancing. I call it the death dance. I call it the death dance partly because it comes in autumn. It comes when things seem to die. It comes before the winter. It comes then before the spring. And that is before the summer. And so we have the four seasons called in due season. And so I go with the picture. I don't try to fight the picture because I can't invent it. It says something to me. I'll take one more. I would not call this an especially glad picture. I would call this more of a picture that got caught off guard. This is like an early frost. And so it's frozen in. This would be like, this would be as though you parked your car when it was thawing, and then you had a very hard freeze overnight, and you couldn't get going because your tires were about 2 inches in the ice. Now, maybe you don't see the connection between that and this. I do. It's to be caught off guard. It wasn't supposed to get that cold that soon. And it's tough. And this, is, to me, then, is also the nativity scene, because I think there's something about this picture that is contrasted to the swaddling cloths and the warm child. But it's something like being caught out in the world alone. And so I connect this with the cradle. And I can do that. You could do lots of things with it. For instance, you could look at that picture and you could say that, I'll tell you what this could be like. If you were had a basketball team that was going great, and this was the last game of your year, and you were playing the team that was at the bottom, and they won. Is that right? Yeah, that's that kind of a feeling, the unexpected thing. And then, but that isn't the end. But it hurts.
Well,
I've done little brochures. This is one of my favorite brochures that went out of print. They printed very few. And it was done for a little program in the Luther League several years ago. Once upon a time, there was a father who had a house, and in his house he had two sons. Did you see the boys? Bunch of squares. Don't you see them?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Okay. The father and his two sons. Now, I don't know. The father happens to be blue and the two sons are green. I don't know what that means. Doesn't mean anything yet or at all. And there they were in the house. And then I must make sure that I'm going. Yeah, here we are. And in fact, I'm giving you a very, I hate doing this in a way, because if we have any prowlers in here who would sneak off with this idea, fine, but don't send it in until, this is a thing that I am working on right now, that the one son said to his father, give me something, and the other son said, me too, right? So now they're both, more independent and therefore outside the triangle. And one son took his and went away and the other son didn't. And then it's a whole story. And not only do you have the sons in terms of relationship, but also in terms of what?
Size.
So I've done this with teenagers and they love it. I didn't know I would do it. And that's part of being creative. You don't know what you're going to write, and you don't know what you're going to say, and you don't always know what you're going to do. You take that chance. You just keep going and let one thing influence, you know, the next. And they touch each other. This was in Menominee, and I asked one fellow, three boys and girls to come up, and then a pastor whom they liked to get even with. It's always fun to pull in an adult. And he was to be the mother in the prodigal son story. So they didn't have any, you know, how do you move yourself around? How do you get bigger and smaller? You know, we didn't work with this bigger and smaller thing yet. We worked, first of all, only with relationships. I asked him if they knew the story. Yeah. Tired of the story? Yeah. Well, that's the one thing about the creative person, is that you don't get tired. You rediscover something about which bored you to death. You rediscover the four seasons of the year. You rediscover the colors of the church. You rediscover what a pew is by getting a hold of each end and bending it till it feels like a bow. At all. You rediscover something. You don't destroy and say, well, done with that, we'll start over somewhere else. There's nowhere else to start but to go from where you are. So we were there, and they wanted something to get a hold of, you know. So I said, well, we've got four Elmer's glues and a big table. So each one took a hold of an Elmer's glue. It was just like a safety blanket. It was beautiful. They just stood there and they clung to their Elmer's glue. And I said, who will tell the story? And a girl told the story. Once upon a time, there was a father with his Elmer's glue out, who had a wife. No. Wife moved her glue out, and two sons. And they liked each other very much, and they got very close. And the whole story began to, you know, you could just as well have done it on a chalkboard, only we didn't have a chalkboard, all we had a table. And we didn't have chalk, but we did have Elmer's glue pieces. We could have had spools, could have had pieces of anything. And that's a thing, too, about creative people, that they don't need a lot of props if they just got something within grasp. So the whole story was done, and when they were done, I said, how did you see the story now? And they said, by distance, that was the word they used. I said to them, do you know what distance means? Yeah. Near, far, close and away, great words in the story. But wouldn't it be fun if we could add another dimension, that is the dimension of, huh? So what kind of, now you can't do that with Elmer's glue. What's that?
Size.
Suppose, but you can't make it bigger and a smaller with Elmer's glue bottle. So what could we use?
Oh,
what?
A
balloon is exactly. We could use a balloon. Now we can add. Now I asked them if they knew what, you know. Yeah. Oh, you know. Now all of a sudden, this whole second dimension. Now, and give me another dimension that we can add with a balloon.
Third dimension.
Namely.
Depth
and color, and I mean, then you can even write on. But as soon as you start writing words on the thing, as far as I'm concerned, it becomes less creative. So I think that, therefore, I think the creative person finally doesn't destroy, but the creative person, by using words, I think, wants to get beyond the words. And nevertheless, it would be a great way, would it not, to do it with balloons, and that everyone would then not only have the color, but to have the choice of how big the balloon shall be according to the feeling that this person has in the story at this particular time. Now, just to sit there when a Sunday service gets a little long and to think of the gospel reading in terms of colored balloons isn't bad. I mean, it works real well. There's no end to the imagination. There's just no end to the kinds of things that one can do. Now, just a few more, and then I want to read. I want to read one here. I'm going to leave some of these around. But Sister Noemi, who did photography primarily of nature, when I went to Europe, I said to her, we're going to be away for quite a while, so, and that's important to creative people, because maybe you don't think that I, well, this nun really checks on me as much as my wife in some regard. She gets mad at me, and she says, why don't I ever hear from you? Like I wrote her three weeks ago. And she called me long distance and says, what's happening to that manuscript? So I feel like saying, who's running my life? But she cares enough to call and to write and to cry. So when I went to Europe, I said, go to the junkyard. Something to tell a nun to go to the junkyard. And she did. She went to the junkyard, and she then began to photograph not flowers, but junk. And this summer, she's in Chicago photographing people. So she's gone from nature to junk. That's very, very interesting. It's taken her a while. I think she's discovering her freedom, too. She's now teaching the Blackstone Range, not Blackstone Rangers, is that possible? Some of the Blackstone Rangers are enrolled in her class. Well, here for instance is a picture. I'd say these, they're not going anywhere. Would you say they're not going anywhere? I'd say it's done. They had something going for them once, but I'd say that that's done. And so this picture gets the word done. I want to show you one picture up here that little children titled for me. I had written this poem, and then I took this picture very, very enlarged to a Good Friday service. We at length discussed this service, this picture, until children were saying phrases. And finally, I had them down to words. And when one child shouted, Good Friday is ouch, I went back home, rewrote the poem, and titled it Ouch, because that's exactly, everyone knows, that's a universal word. Ouch is the name of this poem, and ouch is the name of Good Friday. And, a theologian could say ouch isn't the only way to speak of it. No, that's true. But it's one way to say it. And I want to read one, and I like this one of Hannah. Oh, I'll read the one of Adam. I looked at this, and this is Adam Be Seated. These are very funny. If you don't get too serious about any of these things, that there's nothing to do with this thing. You can't put it in your living room, really. you can just sit down. It says more than anything else, be seated. And the point that I want to make here, because this is a story of all Old Testament characters, is that there's a place for a man on the earth to sit down and to till it, to toil with it, to wrestle with it. If it's out of dirt or concrete or steel or ore or paint, or if it's people in a classroom or whatnot, that's his earth and he has a place to be in it. And that's what this one's about. I don't have time to read it. But I want to read something, because what I like best is what isn't published. I want to read about a guest soloist. He was a violinist that we had at our school not long ago. And people thought, you know, what's he writing? And in fact, people often ask me, what do you do with the pencil all the time? And I don't really know what to say. But when this virtuoso was done, I went past him and said to him, you made me write a poem. And this really rather excited him, and it excited me too, because of a strange thing that happened. I want to read it sort of as a dialogue, because I think when I write, I kind of quarrel in here. I argue a little. I have two or three people going. As I wrote, I said I write in columns. I also, you've got your loud and your soft voice. You've got your masculine, your feminine going in there, and your whole debate. He's a virtuoso, a graduate of the symphony, guest soloist. The children are glued to him. Their black and their red uniforms are as quiet as a checkerboard. I like that line. It's not important, but when you see elementary children in bands and orchestras, you know, they look like a checkerboard up there, if the colors are right, if they're sitting just right. Yeah. Their black and their red uniforms are as quiet as a checkerboard. They're like hypnotized. The violin is like a toy to him. He's like a pro, and he couldn't fumble it. Forgive me, I can't understand how a kid can hang onto that violin under here, you know. That's tougher than holding a football in here, I think. So I think it'd be very easy to fumble a violin, and how would that look? You know, can you imagine? Just imagine that virtuoso had slipped. It'd be awful. Now, you know what happens to a football player when, you know, is that they said he was tackled hard. But what do you do when you stand up there alone and no one's going to touch you? You've got this thing tucked in here. It's like I don't know if they have training for that. Apparently they have. I know they have training for that. He's like a pro and he couldn't fumble it, even if the whole violin section tackled him. It's tucked in there tight and free. Because I noticed it was tight. He could just, you know, wiggle that thing around. It was going all over. And you who know violins, you must know how that is. And his left finger it's tucked in there tight and free. No more comments. And his left fingers slide over the four strings. The strings are like waxed, like an ice rink. And his fingers do acrobats over the surface of the nylon. They jump on the strings with the vibrato of a trampoline. They are limp. They are trained to jump four octaves and to send chords and solos into their ears and into their eyes. It is also what they see him begin, play seven measures and stop. A virtuoso stop in the front of all the children, stop and start over, retuning the one string. Everyone looking, he just quit. In the middle of the seventh measure, he quit. The string was not right. Well, it was not noticeable. No one could tell. It was sharp, flat. It took only 10 seconds. It had taken long at the beginning, tuning it up, tightening the tension bars. He has a sensitive ear. He should have gotten it right then. This was a performance, his first. They'd only heard of him. They'd waited long to hear him and to see him. It seemed more like a rehearsal, stopping to tune. On the very first page, they saw him. No one moved. They seemed surprised, that he opened himself up to criticism. They didn't budge when he did it. No one has budged for five numbers, except to applaud four numbers, four ovations, and there will be a fifth. But they'll remember that he stopped to tune the violin. We'll all remember that the one string wasn't right, that he stopped tuning, that he did it as though it was part of a piece, that he tuned it and started over. They'll probably bring him back for an encore, even if he stops now, to retune the string. Well, you know, that wasn't really the point of the whole evening, but it was the only thing that I wanted to remember, because you can't remember everything. I haven't any idea what any of the numbers were. All I know is that when he was seven measures in, he stopped. And everything else, everything that night was an ovation. Well, now, if we meet some more, as I said, from now on, we'll, I think Carol Hinderly said, we'll probably have some 4 o'clock times or some other times when we do some creative thinking and writing. I'd like to do that with a group such as this, but if you want to do it individually or in small groups or just as you will, I'd like that very much. I think that it would be unfortunate if you know, we went away from here not having written something, some of us having written something together or individually, and then having a chance to sit and read it. We put a time limit on, like, you know, 5 minutes of reading. So you'd hold me down, too. I have nothing more to say now because there is no more time. You have nothing to say because I didn't give you any time. Yes, sir.
Oh,
yes.
Do you think you have a special talent for this, or did you have to develop it and have to work on it?
I had to work on it very much. I still have to work on it very, very much. I taught 42 seminarians last quarter. The first day I gave them a book, a book for the pupils called a trimester book. It's just about three times this big. And I said, you must tear every page off. I had drilled it three holes. You must, in this quarter, tear every page out and put it back together. And they wouldn't, you know, many wouldn't do it. So then I would have to rehearse. And I said, well, now I'm going to tear this apart. And I began to talk to every page and tell this page what I wanted to do with it, and I thought I could improve on that. Maybe I would put it in another place. And began to talk to this thing so that by the time the semester was over, the quarter was over, every seminarian had done this, had put it back together, some with bolts and nuts. It was absolutely fantastic how they had discovered, every one of them had discovered, that creativity is not to destroy, but it is really to restore. It is to see death and life. And this rehearsal broke some of them open for writing. Some of the greatest writing these guys ever did, they did then. I think of one fellow who took his book and put it back together in 5 different dimensions. First of all, he put it together, having now redone the entire cover by recutting the words and reorganizing them. That was one. He saw not God's word is God's world, but God's world is God's word. Now, that's quite a whole new thing. So he didn't destroy the cover. He just cut it up and reorganized the words. The second thing he did was he went to all the newspapers and he found the world that he thought his class lived in, and he put that all the way through. The third thing he did was he went to the ad section and saw some of the concepts. He slugged those in. So already he had 3 dimensions that beyond the book. You know, he's the kind of guy who would have said, until we said to him, a book is only a book. You know, it's only paper. What, you know, you are the master of it. Now you go work on this thing. The fourth thing he did was he put a game of jacks in. And he said that he could show his class how to play the game of jacks all through the unit. I couldn't understand what he meant. But he knew what he meant, and he was going to do this. And the fifth thing he did was, I brought an artist in one day, interviewed the artist for an hour and a half. What does paper say to the teacher and to the class? You know, all this. And so he went home and he did the thing now with a spectrum of colors. That was fifth. So he had all these different colors, you know, you just pull it out like an accordion. And the sixth thing he did was he wrote a poem to yellow, to red, to orange, to blue, and that was six dimensions. So that he took this book, which after he had taken all of the binding, all the glue, all of this out, became a toy to him, a plaything, clay, and he was a creator. Now he learned that quarter. Now we could say, well, you know, he was basically creative. Well, he's basically destructive because he was taught in a system, as most of us are taught in a system, to destroy and say that's wrong and this is right, instead of, I think the creative version believes in death and resurrection more, not starting over in the sense of somewhere else, but starting over from where one has just been. And it's the motif of the four seasons of the year. And I think that's something one learns, and one develops, and works with. I have to work at listening. I have to work at listening, and then sorting out, and then writing down to remember what I want to think about some more. I have to work. I get very angry because I train many writers. I get very angry, impatient, because they don't write down things that they hear that are clues. They want to remember it all, and they remember very little. And so they have a very meager file from which to draw when they want to do some creative writing. They don't have a file. I don't believe in files as organized people believe in files. I believe in files as a pile. But I believe in files. There's more than one way to file.
Is it possible to be
fully? No, I mean truly original. No, I don't really know what that would mean, because I prefer to borrow. I prefer to know that someone said something that I will now expand. That there's fellowship in that for me. And I often write where that thing came from, where that happened. And I like to go back, if it's someone who feels unimportant or, you know, I like to go back, and I often do, and say, remember when you said that line? How would they remember when they said that line? It was so casual. Do you remember when you did that? And a lot of this, I think this is where I get my kicks in terms of fellowship with the Christian church. I guess that's where I get it. And we all have our own ways. Okay, I didn't mean to keep you so long, and thank you. And stay around or come around whenever you can if you have any desire to look at this.